The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back to another reading of the annual Christmas issue of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina, for December 2023. And something very appropriate here, now that it is 11 or 12 days before Christmas, we are going to read The 12 Days of Christmas, Reimagined. We took some, creative liberties when we combed through our state's archives to find a few favorite stories that carry the tune of a Christmas classic. 12 Drummers Drumming. Located in a semi-rural area, bounded by ball fields and brick ranches in Monroe, the four tidy Ludwig Drums Manufacturing buildings project a low-key presence that is at odds with the rollicking international reputation of the instruments produced there. Inside, the vibe is decidedly more upbeat. Encouraged by management, the employees work to the music they love, transforming a routine factory tour into a movable feast of American song. Even though Ludwig's artistry spans countless percussion styles, and a who's who of performing artists, Ringo Starr remains the star ambassador, illuminating the company's past, some 59 years after the famous 1964 Ed Sullivan Show telecast when the Beatles invaded America, the vintage Black Oyster Pearl kit that Ringo played, now made right here in North Carolina, remains Ludwig's most popular drum model. That was written by Brad Campbell in the July 2023 issue. And there's a picture here of Ludwig drums. Of course, it says Ludwig and USA underneath. It's kind of cute how they did it. They wrote the L in script, and even though the rest of the letters are not in script, and the way the bottom of the L comes, they just sweep it down underneath half of the letters, and then they end the G with halfway toward the center, and right between the place where those two bands meet, it says USA. So it reads Ludwig, USA. And it's a pretty band set of black and white swirls, and there's a symbol on top. 11 Pipers Piping. Dancers wearing tartan kilts and knee-high socks raise their arms above their heads in the stag-like shape characteristic of the Highland Fling, an ancient display of strength by warriors after a victory. Some performers at the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games don a green, gray, and blue tartan designed to reflect the mountain. In 1956, Agnes McRae Morton, a descendant of Highland Scots, co-founded the event, which at the time only consisted of some Scottish dancers and athletic events. Her son, Hugh Morton, who bought Grandfather Mountain in 1952, helped make the event what it is today, thanks to his influence as one of the state's most prolific photographers. Now, each July, about 40,000 people come to McRae Meadows for 4 days of festivities, including bagpipe bands, whiskey tastings, sheep herding, a Scottish cultural village, and More, written by Katie Kane from the July 2023 issue of Our State. 10 Lords A-Leaping. The shag is like a tango without the gravatas. If performed correctly, it can seem like a waltz on steroids, with soulful horn punches from the brass section swooning into the groove. Carolina Girls, the best in the world, sang General Johnson, and the chairman of the board swinging in sympathy with the horns. I can't even hear three bars of that song without smelling salt water and cocoa butter tanning lotion, without seeing the tide tag around the legs of a pier. The Embers anthem, I love beach music, I always have and I always will, pointed out a lifestyle and an unparalleled optimism that could only come from long walks on a warm, secluded beach. The Carolina Shag is certainly the offspring of the beach music tradition, merged with a healthy dose of Motown, and even as a mongrel form, it still is more intimate than the singular dancers of the 60s surf variety. Shag partners are in constant thrall to one another, in a pocket of shared rhythmic lunge and parry, reacting to the beat in one move and anticipating it in the next. Keith Flynn from the August 2014 issue. 9 Ladies Dancing. There's more to ballet than meets the eye, says Zalman Raphael, artistic director and CEO of the Carolina Ballet. There's a subtext to the dancers gliding and twirling and leaping across the stage. Like in The Nutcracker, Raphael says, all these stories are metaphors for life and hope and harmony and dreams. When Raphael moved to Raleigh to join Carolina Ballet in 2005, the company was less than a decade old, but it was helmed by experienced members, like founding artistic director Robert Weiss, who were passionate about passing down the art form. The repertoire that Weiss created had a level of atmosphere and craft that Raphael had experienced growing up around New York City Ballet, on a fraction of the budget. Now Raphael hopes to continue what Weiss started. Return visits reward ballet goers with a deep understanding of the stories and symbolism that play out on the stage, he says. It's like learning a language. Katie St. Singh from the February 2021 issue. 8. Maids A-Milking. In 1984, the late Virginia Sue Ginny Tate would drive through the rolling countryside south of the climax, striking up conversations with fellas at filling stations and inquiring about land for sale. Her two Nubian goats often rode shotgun with her. Ginny had grown up on a farm in central Illinois, so when she found an abandoned 40-acre tobacco farm along Jess Hackett Road, she fell in love with the place. Before long, her two goats had become 20. As a hobby, she made cheese out of the excess milk they produced. Raising all those kids, Ginny made a name for herself in the community, and folks began calling her the Goat Lady. In 1995, her brother Steve and his wife Lee moved from Illinois to help her start a full-fledged goat dairy farm, one of the first licensed in North Carolina. After tossing around ideas for a name, they settled on the most natural fit of all, Goat Lady Dairy. Written by Brian Mims from the January 2018 issue. A couple of pictures here. One is of a goat, just his head, looking at us. He has that long beard underneath his chin. And a picture of the farm. It says, Goat Lady hosts monthly dinners featuring its cheeses, like the Providence cheese shown here, along with locally raised meats and produce. 7 Swans A-Swimming. To those familiar with eastern North Carolina in the winter, The preserve doesn't look anything special at all, until suddenly a cloud of starlings and red-winged blackbirds erupts from a field, swells and settles like a living breath. A welcome to a place made for birds, not people. Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge encompasses more than 100,000 acres across Washington, Hyde, and Terrell counties. It's a sanctuary for migrating birds, with Pocosin Swamp pews, trees for buttresses, baptismal fonts made of soggy peat, and glimmering ponds. The dirt roads and viewing platforms are drivable, but the land is meant for wild things, not us. In November, December, and January, 10,000 winged vacationers pour in. More than 20 species of migrating ducks, tundra swans, and snow geese have made the refuge their winter retreat. North Carolina isn't home for these birds, but still, they need North Carolina. Eleanor Spicer Rice from the January 2020 issue. Double page spread under the article here. It says at Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge, lines of tundra swans push through the sky like long distance swimmers, their flanks flashing silver in the sun. Now we see the lake here. It's very calm. Lots of swans are on the surface, just looking around at each other. And there are five swans in flight, and they are pretty much in a line as they take off at an angle from some spot outside of the picture and headed off to the right-hand side. Six geese a-laying. Though it's known for eggs today, Braswell Family Farms got its start as a grist mill in 1943 when Eugene and Joe Braswell purchased the 1834 Bodies Mill down the road from their family farm northeast of Nashville. Customers would walk up onto the front porch, hand over a bag of corn, and wait to have it ground. Eventually, cornmeal turned into bagged feed, and as livestock agriculture evolved, Braswell Milling Company transitioned to commercial bulk feed. From there, venturing into the livestock business was a natural progression. Today, Trey Braswell owns the company with his father, Scott, who inherited it from his father and uncle, who inherited it from their father and uncle before that. Braswell Family Farms is the second largest franchisee for the nationwide egg distributor Eglin's Best. If you've ever eaten an Eglin's Best egg between North Carolina and Pennsylvania, chances are good that you've eaten a Braswell egg. Rebecca Waltz from the April 2022 issue. We're down to five golden rings. On a Sunday in 1799, Little Meadow Creek was nearly dry, but 12-year-old Conrad Reed decided that he'd rather fish in this shallow spot than go to church. As the boy waited for a bite, he saw a strange yellow rock protruding from the water. He plucked the rock from the creek bed and carried it home. Conrad's father, John Reed, couldn't figure out what it was. A silversmith in Concord couldn't identify it either. He could only say that it weighed 17 pounds. For the next 3 years, the Reeds used the rock inside their house as a doorstop. Eventually, John showed it to a jeweler, who identified it as gold, the first documented gold found in the United States, kicking off the country's first gold rush. Until 1848, gold mining ranked second only to agriculture as the state's most economically successful industry. North Carolina led the nation in gold production and gave a young country a new kind of wealth. Caron Mayers from the March 2012 issue. Four calling birds. When R. Wayne Bailey started his career as a field biologist in 1945, the sight of a wild turkey Even the sound of a distant gobbler was a rare, if not totally absent, aspect of the spring woods across most of the South. In 1970, there were only about 2,000 wild turkeys in all of North Carolina. Bailey helped pioneer many of the methods of trapping and transplanting to restore populations. He helped move hundreds of wild turkeys from their few North Carolina strongholds, such as the Roanoke River bottomlands, to woods that hadn't known a gobble in decades. And through it all, he never got over the thrill of seeing a turkey in the wild. In 2015, North Carolina's wild turkey population stood at 265,000. Today, there are birds in every county. In April and May, you can rise at dark 30, find yourself in a quiet Carolina forest, and very likely hear that guttural, unmistakable, otherworldly sound, the gobble of a wild tom turkey looking for love. Three French hens. Well, this is not an article exactly. This is a recipe for apple-stuffed chicken breasts. So I'm not going to go through the whole thing. We're just going to skip the French hens part, but there's a picture down at the bottom. It says, this dish is perfect for your holiday table, even if you don't actually use French hens. Two turtle doves. Shoulder deep in sunflowers, I watch the sky. I'm perched on a 5-gallon bucket with my dog, Minnie, at my feet and a shotgun across my lap. I mop my forehead with a sleeve. I'm humming a happy tune, and oddly, it goes like this. It's the most wonderful time of the year. In fact, I've been humming that Christmas ditty for a few weeks now, despite the broiling heat and the lack of gingerbread and sugar plums in the cupboards. It's my favorite Christmas song ever, because today is my favorite day ever, the most magical day ever. Today is the opening day of dove hunting season. For many in North Carolina and across the South, Labor Day weekend is a beginning, not an end, the first of a coming procession of magical days. At some point, I'll break out in song. After all, it's the most wonderful time of the year. T. Edward Nickens, from the September 2023 issue. And finally, number one, a partridge in a pear tree. The house on the wooded hill was an ideal respite when, in 1935, a young novelist and literary critic named Hamilton Basso moved in. Writing came easier on the rambling house he called Partridge Hill, overlooking the French Broad River Valley in Brevard, where only a distant train whistle could break the spell of isolation. That is, until Thomas Wolfe came to town. Basso and Wolfe had become friends through their mutual editor. When Wolfe finally returned to the Asheville area to reckon with the place and family he could never quite escape, it was Basso who welcomed him home. Today, the house, which has been owned by four families since the Bassos, is every bit the warm, gracious farmhouse and a whimsical two-bedroom cabin perched on the bluff above it, called the Partridge Nest, provides a getaway to anyone hoping to find the same woodland quiet that Wolfe and Basso once filled with their brash ideas and aching stories. Louise Jarvis Flynn wrote that in the March 2018 issue. And down at the bottom it says, read more. To read the full-length version of these 12 stories as they originally appeared in the magazine, visit ourstate.com/12days. And it looks like it might be 12-days if you're actually going to go follow that up. In the time remaining today, I'd like to poke at a few of the shorter articles in the front half of the magazine. This one is in the Welcome Home, A Year in the House, or Year in This House section. A writer reflects on the everyday objects that make a North Carolina house feel like home. Comfort and joy. In December, home takes on a different shape, opening up to welcome friends and family, festive traditions, a new year. At the center of the merriment, one very sparkly tree. Written by Drew Perry, one of my very favorite authors in our state. Maybe I love the mutable spaces the best, the movable feast rooms, the ways the house can shift, a party that spills off the porch and into the driveway, the card tables strung all the way through the living room that one Thanksgiving, the den long doubled as a playroom, and my boys went through an extended phase, perhaps not totally over, wherein all of the sofa cushions and pillows and most of the bedding from their rooms went into the building of elaborate multi-story forts, often during thunderstorms. The kitchen is for soups and stews, but also homework. The dining room is a library and a wintertime greenhouse. The living room, visible from every downstairs room, is mudroom, foyer, school storage, fireside living, and dog lookout. The house is wide open downstairs. Each space seems to reach out for every other. Come Christmas time, like so many families, we move things around. The little 50s curio cabinet, repurposed as board game storage and a bookshelf, slides around the corner in from the living room to the dining room. The picture that hangs on the dining room wall has a special drawer in the sideboard. There's no easy way to reconfigure the furniture downstairs that would land our tree in the front window, so for us, instead, the tree's dead center in the house. It makes a kind of sense. The living room is huge, the stairs in one corner, and the door to the den in another, so half of it is a sort of grand, unusable space, perfect for dogs romping through, for a card catalog we found east of Raleigh, and each December for the tree. We take the boys to the tree lot at night to let them run the rows of Fraser firs under the lights. We choose two, a biggish, hopefully pretty tree for downstairs, plus the saddest tree on the lot, a Charlie Brown tree that we fear no one else might adopt. That one comes home for the upstairs landing, for the kid tree. One year it was short and round, the kid shrub. I hope the boys will come home from college and still decorate a kid tree. I hope they'll still run the lot at 21. I certainly still have the urge. This, for me, is a signal childhood memory. Like the dinner tree we had when I was a kid. My parents called it smorgasbord. And though no one in my family is Swedish, we do too. We've subbed local salamis for their tinned sardines, but otherwise, tree dinner is basically the same as when I was little. Crackers, fruit, olives, cheeses, cookies, and the season's first eggnog. All of this gets eaten while we unpack the name ornaments and the glass orbs, and then my favorite, the wren in a nest made from wood shavings. The kids take plates upstairs and decorate their tree in a style best described as thrown from a medium distance. We hang the precious ornaments downstairs, then the boys come back to work on the big tree too. Christmas jazz, usually 50s and 60s bebop, is the default around here, though there's some songbook stuff we like, and an old Kenny and Dolly record that usually makes its way into the rotation. Life washes through these rooms a little differently at Christmas. We sit in new places, settle by the fire, turn off all the lights, and let the glow of the tree fill the front of the house. Something's on the stove in the kitchen. There are blankets on the front porch. There's kid noise coming from somewhere. Dog fur, muddy boots, another log. Another album, The Tree, Both Trees. Happy New Year, our card says every year, from our house to your house. Short article under Welcome Home, Page Turner. Second Chances, When a woman encounters a magical snow globe in her small North Carolina town, she's given the opportunity to face her past and learn to appreciate the present. In the fictional town of Snow Haven, North Carolina, Diana Merriman appears to have it all, a career as a respected physical therapist, loyal friends, and a loving fiancé. However, this is all a facade. After a traumatic childhood in which she was abandoned by her parents and surrendered to the care of an unsympathetic grandmother, Diana is afraid to show affection, lest she's deserted by those she loves. As a result, the other residents of Snow Haven see her as competent but aloof. Diana's fiancé, Linus, is unwavering in his love for her, even when she cannot bring herself to set a date for their wedding. When tragedy forces Diana to take a hard look at how her behavior affects those around her, she discovers an enchanted snow globe that gives her the ability to live the tragic day over and over again. It's her chance to compel a different outcome, but is it really possible to alter destiny? Perhaps not, but Diana makes the most of the opportunity to try anyway, eventually using it to confront the ghosts of her childhood and become a more loving person. While the premise of a time loop is familiar, the author concentrates on Diana's emotional journey rather than the tragedy itself. Seemingly minor interactions with the patient's co-workers and friends whom Diana sees during the fateful day ultimately help her understand her fears and learn to return their affections. In the end, the underlying message of Through the Snow Globe is a fitting reminder during the holiday season. We never know how much time we have with each other, so we should make the most of the time we have now. Written by Katie Munger. Welcome home, night out. Flat Rock, jingle around the rock. After another year of successful shows, our official state theater celebrates with the loyal audience that's cheered them along the way. From a stage decked in lighted trees and wreaths, the cast of the annual Flat Rock Playhouse Christmas looks out over a crowd of familiar faces. Now in its seventh year, the variety show is just as much a celebration as it is a performance. A chance to recognize all the performers, directors, choreographers, and designers have accomplished over the past year. Many of the audience members have gotten to know each other after enjoying a full season of plays and musicals together. They become familiar, too, with the actors, singers, dancers, and musicians who have graced the stage during all of those performances. The Flathouse Playhouse emerged from a group of traveling performers who first came to West North Carolina in 1940. It's located at 2661 Greenville Highway, Flat Rock, North Carolina, flatrockplayhouse.org. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.